Okay, so we finished the last week on this one of the problems of external validity, the interaction of testing at X, where subject may be sensitized to the treatment by a pretest. I give you the example that is used in the textbook. For example, if they are trying to see the effect of this movie on the attitude to anti-Semitism of people. Oops, I pressed on something. Then it may happen that only because of the pretest, the movie has an effect. I don't think so, but that's the example from the test. Then the next one is the interaction effects of selection biases and the experimental variable. So that is the problem here is that the results can be limited to the group from which the subjects were taken. For example, if you remember the original example in the class of influence of sexual intercourse of pregnancy, suppose you pick people who are in old people's homes, and they are 65 plus, and the result of that experiment probably will be that no pregnancies happen in the treatment group. Can you generalize it to the population of people on Earth? You cannot, yes, because the selection of the population was biased. So the subjects are very important in being able to generalize things later. The typical kind of funny example is this ironic statement that all psychology is the science of behavior of psychology undergraduate students. I have to explain that. Professors in psychology departments do research also, and they want to do research on humans, on people, psychology. And they need subjects. Subjects are, of course, difficult to come by. They have to ask for volunteers, maybe in the street. So what they do is they want to have students participate in experiments. And to make it easier for them, they introduced a requirement for every student to participate in, let's say, 20 hours of experiments. So every student has to pass to the next grade, they have to have at least 20 hours of participation in experiments. This makes sense because they also learn what it is to be a subject when they do experiments themselves later. But it also makes it very convenient for the professors to have subjects, because students will always volunteer, because they have to volunteer for at least 20 hours. So most of the experiments that faculty in psychology are conducting uses undergraduate students. So that's why this ironic statement that psychology is the science of behavior of psychology undergraduate students. It's limited to that population. Of course, we have to kind of treat it, of course, with common sense. If they are testing things that are very common in the population, like, let's say, ability to solve puzzles, for example, psychology students are just as good as any other group of people. But if they are testing something that may be specific to psychology students, then the results are not going to be generalizable. Psychology students are definitely not, they call it alpha subjects, which is mathematics, physics. They are not used to that logic, you know, math. So if you are testing something that requires logic and math, the results may be not very generalizable. But in many other cases, they will be. In any case, psychology, selection of subjects has impact on how well you can generalize. Reactive effects of experimental arrangements. It's the artificiality of the of the lab in which you conduct experiments. For example, subjects want to please the experimenter. They really want to please you. I did some experiments, and very often subjects will ask, is this what you wanted? Am I telling you what you wanted to know, etc. They really want to please the subjects, the experimenter. And that's an artificiality of the setup. They also try to guess your intentions. If they know that you are, for example, testing their negotiating skills, they will try to negotiate in such a way that pleases you. So typically, you want to hide from them that your true intentions. That's if you want to avoid that. There is an effect in psychology known as the Hawthorne effect. Hawthorne is the name of a town where there was a factory, and they studied people in the factory. Normally they work as they work, yes? They were producing something, maybe they are light bulbs. But when they were observed, and maybe videotaped, they worked differently, they worked more efficiently, faster. They were doing more things. And it was because of the artificiality of the experiment. The surrounding was artificial, it was an experiment, they behaved differently. So they called this Hawthorne effect, and it applies to every artificial environment, including environments where you conduct experiments. Often we cannot avoid those reactive arrangements, but we still should continue experimentation. What we do is we have mirrors, one-way mirrors, like in police movies, criminal movies, where they observe the interaction of the criminal and the policeman through a glass. The criminal doesn't realize that they are behind the glass. The same with subjects. Sometimes you have hidden cameras, other naturalistic observations that are not invasive. Have you ever seen the experiment with children and marshmallows? No. Let me see how long it is. It's on TED. Will I find it? Yes, TED.com. The reason why I thought about this is that those reactive arrangements. I think it's A. Yes. That's it. Let's see how long the talk is. If it's just a few minutes, we can play it. How long is it? Five minutes. Let's watch it together. You see an example of experiments with that reactive arrangement. Can't I make it louder? I'll start it again from the beginning. Maybe this is the volume, yes.
If after I come back, this marshmallow is here, you will get marshmallow. I'm here because I have a very important message. I think we have found...
Sorry. Duplicate, that's what I want to do.
The most important factor for success. And it was found close to here, Stanford. Psychology professor took kids that were 4 years old and put them in a room all by themselves. And he would tell the child, 4-year-old kid, 50 seconds, 2 minutes, 4 minutes, 8 minutes. Some lasted 14 and a half minutes. Couldn't do it. Could not wait. What's interesting is that one out of three would look at the marshmallow and go like this. Would look at it, put it back. They would walk around. They would play with their skirts and pants. That child already at four understood the most important principle for success, which is the ability to delay gratification. Self-discipline, the most important factor for success. 14, 15 years later, follow-up story. What did they find? They went to look for these kids that were now 18 and 19, and they found that 100% of the children that had not eaten the marshmallow were successful. They had good grades, they were doing wonderful, they were happy, they had their plans, they had good relationships with the teachers, students, they were doing fine. A great percentage of the kids that ate the marshmallow, they were in trouble. They did not make it to the university, they had bad grades, some of them dropped out, a few were still there with bad grades, a few had good grades. I had a question in my mind. Will Hispanic kids react the same way as the American kids? So I went to Colombia, and I reproduced the experiment, and it was very funny. I used 4, 5, and 6 years old kids. And let me show you what happened.
Hasta para un niño de 4 años, es atractiva la idea de tener el 100% de retorno a la inversión en 15 minutos. Sin embargo, algunos de ellos, tan pronto la puerta se cerró, se perdieron.
So this is hidden camera, that's exactly... They think they are alone in the room. You see that they cannot see that you are observing them, otherwise they will not behave naturally.
So, what happened in Colombia? Hispanic kids, 2 out of 3 ate the marshmallow, 1 out of 3 did not. This little girl was interesting. She ate the inside of the marshmallow. In other words, she wanted us to think that she had not eaten it, so she would get 2. But she ate it. So we know she'll be successful, but we have to watch her. Okay? She should not go into banking, for example, or work in a cash register. But she will be successful. And this applies for everything. Even in sales, the salesperson that customer says, I want that, and I say, okay, here you are. The person ate the marshmallow. If the salesperson says, wait a second, let me ask you a few questions to see if this is a good choice, then you sell a lot more. So this has applications in all walks of life. I end with the Koreans did this. You know what? It's so good. We want a marshmallow book for children. And we did one for children, and now it's all over Korea. They're teaching these kids exactly this principle, and we need to learn that principle here in the States because we have a big debt. We're eating more marshmallows than we're producing. Thank you so much. Mm-hmm.
So I wanted to show you that the kids would behave differently. Did you notice that the moment the adult left the room, they started behaving funny? Yes? When the adult was there, they would not eat the marshmallow. That was the interesting thing. Where are we? think here, I think. Yes. So so you had to make the environment more natural. Here's the next design. It is an improvement on design 4. If you remember, design 4 was the truly experimental design. Yes, the randomization, two groups, one was treated, the other was control, and then measurements before and after. This makes it harder, makes it more complicated. Four groups, and the difference is that in the groups we have the third and fourth group don't have a pretest, so you can calculate the effect that the pretest has on the post-test by just subtracting the differences between the O2 and O5, then you see the difference of the pretest only. Did I ask the question in this room, what is the best design? I think we talked about this, yes? Similar to the question, what is the best search algorithm in computer science? It depends, is the answer. If you want to really see the difference between the with the pretest and not without pretest, that would be the design, but not always worth it. This is a simplification of the design 4. In the design 4, we had pretest also. Here you have no pretest. Why can you do that? If you randomize, then the groups are statistically, with a very high probability, identical. With a high probability. Never have the warrant, the guarantee of that, but the probability is very, very high that this is representative. It can happen if we have, let's say, in a room, 10 ladies and 10 gentlemen, and I assign them randomly to two groups. It can happen that all the ladies are in one group, all the men are in the other group. But is this likely? Very, very unlikely that that will happen. Probability theory is working for us. So typically, groups are going to be identical statistically. There's a high probability of that. If it's the case, then you don't need to test them before the experiment. Why would you if they are identical? The only thing you need to do is test them afterwards, after the first group was treated and the other not. So here we still don't have these, and they are equivalent. The guarantee is, of course, statistical. And that's an interesting thing. In everything that we do, all kinds of empirical work, there is always a non-zero probability that something is very wrong. But typically that probability is very, very small. So can it go wrong this way? Sure, it can. Randomization maybe didn't work. But the probability of such thing happening is not very high, so we don't worry too much. Especially when the group is very high, very big. If the group is big, then the probability is very, very small. So this is the picture again. The threads are just a checklist, so it's a good idea to be aware of them. Whenever you design an experiment, you may actually go through them and see, could anything like that happen? Typically, the sequence is a problem, a hypothesis, an experiment. Women are getting cervical cancer, they are dying. That's a problem. What is the hypothesis? Maybe it is spread by sexual contact, the virus, and then you can test it. And I will repeat that thing again. You should not feel bound by existing experimental approaches. You can be creative, because every one of these designs was at some point proposed. Somebody invented it, somebody proposed it. So you may well be proposing a new design and extend that list of designs. And of course, the main purpose of the course is to make you a critical recipient of research results. Then there are two more presentations in this cycle, in this group of experimental designs. The second one is, let me get that, those presentations. We have factorial designs first. Factorial designs are, it's a short presentation just to make you aware of that. Typically we have, the typical situation is, you've seen these slides, so we don't need to go through them. What we want to do is we want to discover whether there is a causal relationship, and these graphs represent a whole group of alternative rival hypotheses. For example, that it's the, where's my, here it is. Why can't I see? For some reason it's not going the pointer. Okay. Let me again duplicate. Okay, this is an alternative hypothesis, that the correlation between smoking and cancer is through a common cause. Here's another one also. So what we want to do is we want to reduce the those rival hypotheses so that nothing else is possible but the one that we want to test. So far in the architectures, we had one independent variable and one dependent variable. So we were manipulating, intervening into one thing, and then observing the effect on the other. Very often in life we have multiple independent variables. For example, if you remember in COVID, COVID is spread by viruses, typically in the air because somebody was coughing or spitting small particles with viruses. We breathe them in and then we get infected. But there was also another thing that I remember there was talking about. Smokers usually have a harder time with COVID. So smoking was another factor that was playing in the effect variable, which is the how hard it hits you, or maybe in the death, dying of COVID. There was another one in Poland and some countries in this part of Europe. People were not getting, people were not dying as much as they were in Italy or Spain. There were many deaths in some of the cities there. And nothing like that happened in Poland. Could be, of course, because we had different rules, we had better isolation. But it could be because some people were postulating that maybe because we had vaccinations to tuberculosis in this country. So in any case, this is just one example, but what happens is sometimes we are dealing with multiple factors, and we may be interested in how they interact in producing the effect variable. These are three pictures that I created with Mathematica, which is a very nice package for solving symbolic mathematical problems, for plotting. In any case, it demonstrates the idea that when you have two variables, one going in this direction, the other one going in this direction, the function of two variables can be anything. It can be like this, can be like that, can be very complicated. So interaction between different independent variables can be anything too. And the idea here is to try to capture the interaction. In general, what we could do is we could have as many groups as there are combinations of values. Suppose we have COVID virus, infection, no infection. Then we have smoking, no smoking. And then tuberculosis vaccination, no tuberculosis vaccination. Three variables of two states, we have eight combinations. We could have eight groups. Every group would have a combination of this. Like we would have people who had tuberculosis vaccination, no COVID infection, and they were non-smokers, and you know, eight groups like this. The problem with that solution would be that we would need a lot of people, a lot of subjects for this experiment, because every group would have to have, whatever, 10 or 20 of these subjects. The second problem is that if you were performing independence tests, then, then you would have to test many combinations, eight groups, and you would need to test every pair, how they interact, are they dependent or independent. That would give you a number of combinations of 2 out of 8, and that's 7 times 4, 28 different tests. If you have four of these variables, or if there are more states, then you have even more combinations. And then you would need to perform individual independence tests. If you do it at significance level 0.05, that significance level causes, it tells us about the probability of type 1 error. Type 1 error is rejecting H0 if it's true. If you have 100 tests, you can expect 5 of them to be wrongly telling you that H0 is false. So it's a typical novice mistake performing many tests. Like you take a data set, you perform many of the pairwise t-tests, but you cannot do that. It's not allowed because there's always a proportion of those tests will come out falsely, will reject this. There's this very simple idea, in case you don't remember that. If you have a comparison of the means, this is the 0.05 threshold. The probability here is 0.05, and this is 0.95, the area under the curve. If you hit once here, it is a non-zero probability of seeing such data, but it has small probability, maybe 0.05, maybe 0.04, 0.03, or whatever. And you decide to say, okay, because the probability of seeing that is so low, I'm rejecting H0. But what if you do, what if H0 is true, and you perform it 100 times? Then, if it's true, then many times you will see it here, in the middle. It's most likely, most probable. But some of them will fall there also, even if the hypothesis is true. So you can expect, if this is the alpha threshold, you can expect the probability of type 1 error is equal to alpha. Smaller than alpha. If you perform many, many tests, you can expect alpha times 1 to fall in this area under the hypothesis that H0 is true, so you are always drawing from this distribution. So performing many tests is statistically not correct. You shouldn't be doing this because the probability that something will lead to rejection of H0 is very high, becomes very high. So that would not be a very good thing to do. An answer to that is an idea by Ronald Fisher, the same Ronald Fisher who proposed the design 4 with randomization, a British statistician. He proposed a statistical procedure called ANOVA. ANOVA is an abbreviation from analysis of variance. A little bit of details about it in some of the next slides. You have multiple factors, and then you have in every combination you have some subjects. The number of these subjects doesn't have to be high. So it doesn't have to be 10, 10, or 20, 20, so that we can conduct a statistical significance test. It can be a smaller number. The total number of all of them can be whatever, 20 or 30, because the statistical procedure is very effective in comparing. He assumed that the mean of every group, mean value, let's say, mean number of deaths because of COVID in each of the group, can be constructed by a linear function of the grand mean. Grand mean is essentially mean of all the points, plus effects of the rho, which is one of the factors, plus effects of the columns, that's the other factor, plus interaction effects. Interaction effects can be like in case of COVID. They were saying that smokers, so if you smoke and you get COVID virus, the effect is going to be worse. The probability of death is going to be higher. So it assumes a certain type of function. This the group mean is constructed by this sum, linear sum. So it's almost like regressing a line to a table. Apparently it's not that bad. By the way, ANOVA can be used also for a single factor experiment. It also works. And some people use ANOVA always for every experiment, whether it's single or multiple factor. Oops. Grand mean here is not the population mean. It's something that that is calculated. It's actually an artificial construct. It's not. You cannot take all the subjects and calculate the mean. It's something that is constructed artificially, the grand mean. Some of vocabulary. Factor is essentially an independent variable. Group is groups are factors in one way ANOVA. One way means single single factor. A level is different values of a factor. So you can have, for example, heavy smoker, moderate smoker, and non-smoker. So three different levels of the variable smoking. The means, of course, are going to be different, like always, if you look at the table. They're going to be different here. That's normal, because we are just, there's randomness, there's noise. The question that is being asked in the procedure is, are they really different? How much can they be explained by variance within the cell and between the cells? So what is happening is variance is compared within the group, within the and then the population, all the groups. The power of ANOVA, so the ability to reject hypothesis null, H0, depends on the group sizes and differences in means and within group variances. Very often in ANOVA, they present the results as box plots. In Polish, I think they call it, there's a variety of terms. Wąsowy, maybe. Z wąsami, świeczka, things like that. Candle and mustache. What it means is it shows you the range of values in each of the groups, but also where most of the points are. This is 95% confidence interval, and this is the mean. So now you can see, if you have three groups, whether the means in the groups are different or they are the same. And with ANOVA statistical procedure, you can calculate whether it's statistically significant difference, whether the difference statistically significant, at what significance level. If you have more than one way, then they usually write like 2 times 3 ANOVA, means that there are two values, two levels in one group, in one factor, three levels in the other factor. So there, the table would have six elements. And with two factor ANOVA, you can very often see in papers when they do multi-factor experiments this kind of plots. I should explain it. That there are two variables that are independent, A and B. They each have three levels, A1, A2, and A3, B1, B2, and B3. And this is the effect. This is actually a three-dimensional picture that was flattened. This is one dimension, the values of A. This is the second dimension, values of B. And third dimension is the effect. And then they flattened it by reducing the third dimension, by projecting the planes onto the existing plane. And this is enough to see the interactions. Like, what can you see here? Well, definitely the effect gets stronger when you increase the level A. So the more viruses you get during the infection, the more susceptible you are to death. B, let's be smoking. The more you smoke, the higher probability that you will, when you get infected, you die. And they are pretty much, there's no interaction between them. The effect of B changing is the same for different levels of A. Yes, you see the effect. The effect of A is the same for each level of B, the same. If it's B1, you see the effect of A is somewhere the difference between the lowest and highest point. But the same is for B and for B2 and B3. The effect of A is the same. And the effect of both A and B is the same. What about this picture? When you see something like this, what happens here? A has positive effect. B has also positive effect. As you change B, the effect is higher. As you change A, the effect is also higher. But it seems that when B is B1, equal to B1, the effect of A is weak. The same when A is A1, the effect of B is weak. But when A is A3, the effect of B is stronger. When B is B3, the effect of A is stronger. So it looks like they are supporting one another. There's positive synergy. They enforce each other. This may not make sense in the context of the example of COVID and smoking, but it's another type of interaction that you may see. As A changes, gets higher, when B is B1 or B2, the effect is negative. So A actually has negative effect on the total effect. When B is B3, A suddenly gets positive effect. Something like that can happen. The other way, when A is A1, B has positive effect. A is A2, has positive effect but stronger. With A3, has positive effect much stronger. Here's another one, very similar actually, but when B is B2, A has no effect. Finally, this is the cross-line interaction. What can you see here? When A is A1, the effect of B is negative. Going from B1 to B3 makes the effect weaker. When A is A3, B has positive effect, strong positive effect. And the other way too, when B is B1, A has negative effect. When B is B3, A has positive effect. When A is A2, B has no effect. When B is B2, A has no effect too. Apparently they see that sometimes. What will you see when you just look at a one-factor experiment. So in this case, for example, if you look at A only, A is the only variable that you change. Of course, this gets averaged by B because we don't control B. B can have different values. Suppose it gets averaged with equal weights. You see something like this only. So A will, as A increases, the effect will increase also. Here also, what about here? The average, if you average this, you'll get something that is that looks a little horizontal, doesn't it? So it will look like A has no effect on, at all. What about B? Well, when you average over A's, it will look like B has a positive effect. As you increase B, effect goes up. But A will have zero effect, here even clearer. What will you see here for one variable at a time? Probably no effect at all. Because if they average out nicely, it will be like a horizontal line here. So there will be no effect. The interesting thing for from the point of view of a researcher is how the two things interact. And in your, for example, experimentation, when you have, you don't need to repeat because you have full control and you can precisely measure, you may still be interested in two things at a time. Yes? Mm-hmm. Then you will manipulate one thing and the other. You'll collect several points for different combinations of values. Then you may observe how they interact. So in any case, multiple independent variables, and we are interested in the interactions between them, and the statistical procedure ANOVA is to declare whether the variables are independent or dependent. Between actually, ANOVA is not very strong. It will tell you for a table like this just one thing: are the factors dependent on the effect or not? Just one statement about the whole table, no matter how big the table is. And then you still have to perform pairwise tests to show, to look at different, whether different pairs are having effect. You've just seen this picture. Factorial designs extend to multiple independent variables, factors. And ANOVA is a statistical procedure that makes the management of resources in terms of the number of subjects very efficient. Finally, I think we should be able to even finish today. We'll see. The last group of designs of experiments of architectures are quasi-experimental designs. Quasi-experimental designs, the idea here is that we have you see this picture, the idea is that there are situations in which you cannot manipulate perfectly. For example, in smoking and lung cancer, that experiment would not be possible to conduct. It would not be ethical, because we know enough now. We know that cigarettes are probably having to do with all kinds of diseases, cancers, lung cancer. So we would not get permission to test humans. Animals, different story. They use animals for this kind of experiments. But it turned out that none of the experiments with animals succeeded in causing cancer. I think it's maybe because, my hypothesis is that it's because animals don't live long enough. So they don't live long enough for lung cancer to develop. Lung cancers develop later, at a later age. I have two cases of lung cancer in my family, my wife's family actually. One was well over 70, the other one was well over 80. The one over 80, you could say, well, cigarettes had no effect on him. Not true, because all of his siblings are still alive. it's a good genes, a very the family just they live long. The old no, actually one of the sisters died 10 or so years after him. She was 95. He died at 85, 87. Anyway, it took him many decades of smoking to develop that. Both of them were smokers. The other guy also smoked a lot, and he developed cancer at the age of 70-something, 75, 77. So it wasn't possible to find, to do it in with animals. There was a study that, I haven't read it myself, but a colleague told about it. They selected smokers. They wanted to do a randomized study, but their subjects were smokers. So they selected, let's say, 500 or 1,000 smokers. They randomly assigned them to two groups. Control, they told them to go home and then smoke whatever they want. And the other group, the treatment, they subjected them to therapy. I don't know what the details was, but there was some kind of torture, I think, telling them about the bad effects of smoking, maybe telling them how to quit smoking, maybe showing them pictures like on the cigarette packs with all kinds of terrible things. But my colleague was laughing at it. He said that in the treatment group, the therapy group, they were dying more often than in the smoking group. It's a funny thing. He was saying that, that the most likely hypothesis is that therapy kills. Who knows? Maybe the stress due to being told how bad it is that they smoke wasn't had an effect. In any case, you could conduct an experiment like this, but I think it would have problem with external validity. Because the results, suppose there were fewer cancers in the treatment group, one thing you could say that if a smoker quits smoking, then he or she has a higher chance of survival, yes? But you couldn't say something like, if you never smoke, you will be healthier, yes? So external validity, again, would be a thing here. But an experiment where you randomly select people, whether they smoked or not, you tell them from today on you smoke, from today you don't smoke, that experiment is impossible to conduct. Now, if you cannot conduct an experiment, and you cannot conduct it, so should you give up? What should we do then? And there are many natural settings in which experimenter can introduce a little bit of a design and a little bit of randomization maybe, but doesn't have full control over the scheduling of the experiment. So a true experiment is not there, but collectively you can call those situations quasi-experimental. You can introduce a little bit of experiment in there. And we should be aware of those situations and still conduct experiments. There are two very nice quotes from the book by Campbell and Stanley. This is the thin book where they listed the experimental architectures. The sense of these quotes is very deep. Essentially, they are saying that in learning the truth about the world, what is important is eliminating rival hypotheses, things that we know cannot be true. What would be a rival hypothesis? Suppose the women and cervical cancer. Nuns had very low incidence of cervical cancer, prostitutes very high. One hypothesis is that it's the mechanics, you know, the sexual intercourse, that mechanical, let's say, hitting with a penis to the on the cervix can cause cancer. Right? Now, can you eliminate that hypothesis? You can. When you conduct an experiment where you I would probably conduct an experiment with condoms. Condoms prevent from transmission of viruses or bacteria, But still, there is mechanics, yes? And when you put on the condom, you realize that incidence of cervical cancer will reduce, will get reduced, yes? Oh, no, sorry, much simpler way of eliminating that hypothesis. Married couples, they have intercourse like everybody else, yes? And married women in marriages where both of them are faithful don't get cervical cancer, yes? So it cannot be mechanics. And look, I didn't even need to conduct any experiments. I just reducing, eliminating rival hypotheses, rival explanations. And then the experiment with condoms would be to demonstrate that when there is no exchange of fluids, there is no infection, probably, and then there will be no cancers. So the whole business is about reducing rival hypotheses. There is an anecdote that I read once. Somebody talked to Thomas Edison. Remember, Thomas Edison invented the light bulb, one of his inventions. He had many. And somebody asked him, boy, I mean, how on earth did you find something that worked? And he said, well, I tried everything else. It didn't work, so this had to work. Of course, he was joking. But essentially, if you eliminate all the possible other possibilities, then you know that this has to be the case. And what can you do to eliminate the possibilities? Well, you could use anything. One of the next things that we are going to talk about is a causal discovery from observations, by analyzing data. You will see that this is also less powerful than experimentation, but it also gives us a lot of information. The same here, the quasi-experimental designs will give us information that is valuable, that we can use to eliminate hypotheses. In that sense, anything that you do, observation, experimentation, learning from data, has value. It has different amounts of value, but has value. So not only experimental designs are the only thing that you can do. So here's where we are in this quasi-experimental designs, where we don't have full control. You've seen this, so it's just to remind you that these problems are still going to be essential there. Notation, and then a handful of designs, just I think three or four designs. Here's the first design that you can imagine. It's a series of observations, then an intervention, and then a series of observations. What can you see? Here's what you can see. These are five different experiments, different treatments, of course. It's just I showed it on one plot. Here's the treatment. In the first one, what you see is the measurements, they vary a little bit, not a lot, but then you see that there is an increase right after the treatment, and that increase is permanent. It stays. Here we see an increase exactly when the treatment happened, but then it's temporary. It goes down again. What could this be? Well, something like, suppose I tell you something important. I teach you, yes? And that has impact on your behavior in the future, permanent. Because you heard it, you thought about this, you accepted it, and use it in the future. It could be starting to exercise, for example. Suddenly you have lower heart rate, you have better condition. What is this? Alcohol, drugs, something that has a temporary nature. Drinking coffee. You drink coffee, your blood pressure goes up. Then after a few hours, it goes down again. Yes. What is this? No effect of the treatment. Essentially, the measure increases, but maybe it's because of maturation, for example. Here, there is an increase, but that increase is very difficult to distinguish from just random variation that happens at other times. Here, there is an increase, the biggest so far, but it looks like there's a trend. It would be good to observe the next, you know, it's going up, essentially. So, this experiment has value, because you can observe what is happening, and there are, of course, possible problems, like history. But then, you know, history would have to happen right here, exactly here, Did I tell you the joke about the tomahawk? Not? Well, it's a silly joke that I remember from, maybe it was college years, a silly joke. Grandma was climbing a ladder in a village to get some cherries from the tree, and her grandson noticed, looking under her skirt, that she is built differently than him and the grandpa. He saw the grandpa before. So he asked, "Grandma, how is it that grandpa has a penis and I have a penis, but you don't have anything there?" She thought that it was too early to explain all the details to the grandson, and she invented a story. She said, "Well, when we were young, grandpa and I went to the Wild West, to the United States, and we were traveling by train. The train was attacked by Indians on horses, and they were, you know, shouting and attacking us, shooting arrows, and one of them has thrown a tomahawk that went through the window and got me there, and you know, cut my penis off. I don't have one." And the grandson is looking really silently, his eyes very large, his mouth open, and says, "Boy, he got you precisely in the vagina." I have to think about this joke whenever I deal with something that is very improbable, you know. Of course, that story that the grandma told was very improbable. Whenever I see something very improbable, then I say, well, it's like in the joke with the tomahawk. History can happen, of course, but why on earth did it happen exactly here when I was manipulating, yes? That's not very likely, is it, if I observe things? Another thing that comes to my mind is that this experiment is something that we do a lot without formalizing it. For example, a mother who has a baby, a child, that is still very, very young, just months young, the child cannot talk, cannot say, "My left arm is aching," cannot say, "I have an ache in my belly," but it's crying. And the mother knows the baby, has been observing the baby for days and weeks and maybe months. Something happens. The baby falls. The baby eats something. The baby has contact with somebody who is sick. And the mother comes to a doctor. Bad doctor will dismiss the mother. So, you are inventing things, yes? Everything is fine. The temperature is fine. You know, everything looks good. A good doctor will listen to the mother, because the mother does an experiment like this precisely. She knows something is wrong. Yes, the behavior is different. She observed the baby before and after. She can even probably attribute to something that she observed around that time when the behavior changed. Of course, this is not a very strong design. It has weaknesses. It has. We cannot get rid of that light, unfortunately. History, but as I told you, this is like a tomahawk. Why exactly there it happened? The same holds for instrumentation. The decalibration happened precisely when I was manipulating. That's very unlikely. Why didn't it decalibrate here or there? Selection and regression, also, why something happened exactly here? Could happen, of course, but why there? Not very likely. Mortality, if looking at individuals and collective data. I can read here, you cannot read here. What it says here is external validity. Well, the problem is that the results may be specific to the population under study, but that's always the case, yes? One thing that we need to watch out, this is the last point, is the delay between the manipulation intervention and the effect. Sometimes the effect will not happen until later. It's like almost, you tell a joke, look at the people, and they are still serious. And then they realize, they understand the joke 5 minutes later, right? It's almost like that. Also, in teaching, it also happens. You may not realize the importance of some of the things that you are teaching, that you are learning, And then later, when you see a situation and suddenly you understand that something that you learned a while back is important, and then it has effect, delayed effect, it can happen. So this design, when the effect happens later, is very difficult to distinguish from a history event somewhere there, right? Because there will be no effect, and then suddenly it happens. Next design. We have a series of treatments and observations. And those treatments are intertwined. So treatment one, treatment zero, treatment one, treatment zero. That is most useful when the effect of the experimental variable is transient or reversible in character. This is more of a joke. When I was in college, my first or second year, one of my colleagues told me the following story. He went to a party, came back home around 5 o'clock in the morning. He was drunk like hell. And he realized that there are exercises at 8 o'clock in the morning, and he was supposed to do a homework that would be graded. I think we had homeworks at that time in college. I was at Warsaw University of Technology. And the homework was calculus, and he was supposed to differentiate, integrate some formulas. And at 5 o'clock in the morning, drunk, he would do that. And he was surprised how very nicely, how well it was going. He could reduce things very nicely and got very nice answer. But then later he thought, well, I should never do any homeworks without drinking or going to a party. But then when he got back the homework checked by the lecturer, he realized that there was an error in every line. Every transformation contained an error. So it was transient, but it had a bad effect. The experiment that was actually conducted, I read about that experiment in 1970s when I was still in high school. They gave cows different music, different types of music, and then they found that when the cows get classical music, they produce more milk than when they get rock music. At that time, that was just rock, you know, the Beatles, Rolling Stones, nothing very hard like heavy metal later at that time. And they discovered that classical music led to better production of milk. What would be a problem with that? The problem with that would be the last point in external validity that we haven't discussed, is that the effect can happen only when there is interference, when there are multiple treatments. For example, the cows could be producing more milk because when they heard rock, they didn't produce much milk, so they had to catch up with production of milk during classical music. So maybe that higher production of milk would be because there was this intertwining of rock and classical music. That could be easy to check. They could offer the cows classical music for a week or for a month, and they could compare it to a month when there was no music at all or rock music. Yes, but this experimental design doesn't check for that. So if you just do this design, then there is of course there's no way you can exclude this specificity to the result to this experimental alternating of the treatment. That's the last threat of to external validity. When X1 is continually present, maybe the effect will not happen. The next design, one of the last one, but there's one more at least. It's a design that you will probably not have dealt with your technical education, that is used often in cognitive psychology. Psychology, there are different branches of psychology. There is clinical psychology, which is when some screws get loose in your brain, they try to tighten them, yes? These are the therapists, you know, helping you with personal problems. There's social psychology that deals with interaction in the society, how societies work, how individuals in the society function. Cognitive psychology is very mechanical. It is interested in the working of human brain. Assuming it's a normal brain, no personal problems, etc. No interactions with other people, just the brain. So how do we solve puzzles? How do we solve mathematical problems? These are the things that they deal with. And in studying the architecture of the brain, short-term memory, long-term memory, they often had to experiment. For example, they would give you a sequence of nonsense syllables like ABF, DGI, etc. You know, nonsense syllables, they meant nothing. And they wanted you to remember those syllables, and they would treat you by interrupting you. Cognitive architecture works in such a way that we have short-term memory, has very short, small capacity. It's like 5 plus minus 2, 7 plus minus 2, depending on the authors, items. If I give you a phone number, like some kind of nonsense phone number, 725-331-120. If you make an effort, you will be able to remember that number for a little bit. What you need to do is you need to repeat those digits in the short-term memory, and you remember them. You can even bring that to the long-term memory. It takes an effort that takes around 8 seconds per item. I don't know if this, in this case it would be per digit or per whole thing. It takes 8 seconds to bring from short-term memory to long-term memory. And then in this, an experiment like this, for example, they would give you those syllables, which you can remember for a while, but the treatment would be to interrupt you. If you are interrupted when trying to remember a phone number, very often it will disturb you and you will lose some of the digits. So that helps them to study that, that effect. Interruption may be of the same type, of maybe different types, and stimulus that they would have to give you has to be identical for all practical purposes, so there may be no longer-term effect of the stimulus, like you learn the stimulus, and an example would be nonsense syllables. They are always syllables. You need to make an effort to remember them, but learning a syllable BDF will not help you in remembering a syllable MPI next time, yes? So in that sense, these are equivalent designs, but you cannot remember. They're equivalent, but they're not identical. So learning nonsense syllables, and then that's what I told you about. Learning the influence of group opinion on voting schemes. Voting schemes are O's, group opinions are X's, and then M's are equivalent questionnaires that test conformity of subjects. And this is an example from the textbook. This type of settings. Here's another one, design. Two groups of subjects, and one of them is treated. The groups are not randomized, so they are occurring in natural settings. An example, each of you has already taught or will be teaching even in this program. Sometimes you have the same subject, but two different groups, two or three different groups of students, a morning, afternoon. You do exercises or laboratory exercises. And they are naturally occurring. You have no guarantee that they are identical. In the morning, the people come with, let's say, starting with A, the letters, their last names. Afternoon is with K. They are different. Why they are different? Because throughout their school, when they had names starting with an A or or B, they were probably often asked as first. Maybe that makes them prepare better for the classes. Or morning, they need coffee. In the afternoon, they are already kind of fresher. So they are different, non-equivalent. one of the groups is tested, used a lot in natural settings, in experiments, in education. Every time I teach, I try to do things different. That's the treatment. And then I observe the effect of that treatment on my students. But I can assure you, every year students are different. They're just different. The dynamics is different. So they are not equivalent, not to say. That's one of the problems. So with pretest, you test them, you treat them, and then with post, you check with the post-test if they are, what the effect was. It is definitely different from the design 4, the one with randomization, because they are not randomized. They are in two different groups, selected not randomly. I guess the experiment with the British, with the limes, which I told you about, yes? I think I told you, the limes, would be of this type. None of them, none of the sailors had scurvy, scorbut, and then one of the boats had limes, the others not, and they measured afterwards. They didn't randomize the sailors. Okay, you are going to go on boat A and boat B. They were naturally occurring. But the sailors were, you know, not too different, I guess. Oh, well, they were different. Every boat had its own dynamic, for sure. But for the purpose of this experiment, they were similar enough. The weaknesses are regression, of course, if they are based on extreme scores, maturation, interaction of selection variable X and the measure. These are the possibilities. Here's, I think, one, not the last one, but one before last. It's called counterbalance design. This is what you do when you have multiple treatments and you want to compare those treatments. I did an experiment like this in my first year of doctoral studies. I had two ways of explaining probabilistic inference, and one group was control, so no explanation at all. Measurement was how well they understand the problem. Are they able to replicate, calculate the probability? And I was having my subject undergo different order of those things. So I had a handful of subjects in every group. I had three groups, and I changed the order of application. So that was my design. Why the rotation? Rotation is because one treatment, like X1, can have impact on X2 when it was before X2. When I gave them an explanation of one type, they would understand it better, the second type, or the third type with no explanation. So it was counterbalanced by offering them in different order. So if X1 precedes X2 here, and here, X2 is before X1 in this design, in this group, and in this group. So every pair is in different order, depending on the group. As you see, many groups, many subjects, but it allows you to compare the different treatments. It kind of you calculate the average across the four groups of the treatments. Of course, things that can happen is effects of repeated testing, history, maturation, practice, and cumulative carryovers or transfer. Many things that are possibly going wrong here, but it's an interesting experiment, and I think that it gives us valuable results. I made a mistake. I think there are two designs more. This is a design that is used very often in large populations, cities, factories, schools, military units, where you cannot differentiate between the groups. So what you do is you essentially divide them randomly into groups without them knowing, and then you can test only people in the first group. You can treat them if you want to present, make sure that they are treated the same way. It's nice to treat them the same way. And then you test the other group afterwards. What would be a good example? A public campaign. It's very difficult to shield some part of the population from the public campaign, because they all watch the TV, they listen to the radio. So you give the treatment to everybody, but you test on the part of the people before and on the part of the people after. And you decide randomly which of the part whom you are going to test before and after. It's a great design, improvement on the design too. Design too, if you remember, there was testing before and after. Because it controls the effect of testing and interaction of testing with X. Of course, many things can be happening here. This is the weakness. Mortality, instrumentation, history. Calibration also, of course. Two designs. This is probably never used. That's what Campbell and Stanley, the authors of that review book, say. They invented it, probably. You can control for the interaction of testing and X. There are two additional groups that don't undergo the testing. Sometimes you can afford it, maybe not in a public campaign, but sometimes in a military unit or, when you can hide from some of the people that they are treated and they are not treated. When you can hide treatment. And this is the last design. It's an improvement on that simple with time series. You have a control group. That will fix the problem with the history, because you can use that group to control for history. I think it's not necessary, because that probability of the history event happening here is probably enough to me. We have still 5 minutes. Let me conclude with just a few summary slides. We have to remember that these designs have been proposed by somebody, but there will be other designs always, and maybe you will be the ones creating other designs. You know the story of Archimedes, or I'll remind you, because you may remember the fact that he jumped out of the bathtub naked and ran to the king, shouting Eureka, which is Greek for I got it, I discovered it. The story is that the king got a new crown from a goldsmith, and the king was suspecting that the goldsmith did not put enough gold in the crown. He was suspecting that the proportion of gold was not right. But the only way to prove it would be to melt the crown, because they had the idea of the proper weight, ciężar właściwy, proper weight, and he could get the volume. He knew the proper weight of gold. He could check whether this was pure gold or not. But he didn't want to melt the crown, because it was very pretty. So he asked the wisest guy in town, Archimedes, to solve the problem. And when he was thinking about it for a while, but when he took a bath one day, he noticed that the slave probably put him too much water. When he was getting into the bathtub, the water was pouring out. He got an idea of how to calculate the volume of the crown. That was the idea. One experiment. Of course, as an engineer, I would conduct that experiment 10 times to calculate the average volume, because of course there will be drops of water attaching to the crown actually the volume of water, the way you measure is if you want to precise measure. They say about Middle Ages, burning of witches. When a woman was accused to be a witch, she would be burned. Actually, they had trials by water and trial by fire. They would throw her in a deep water. If she drowned, oops, sorry, we made a mistake, she was innocent. If she floated, she's probably a witch. Then they would conduct a trial of fire. If she would burn, oops, sorry. If she didn't burn, she was a witch. Final thing, a design. Do you all know the story of Solomon? Solomon? It's a proverbial wisdom of Solomon. Solomon. So he had a dream. God told him, I give you everything that you want because I like you. Solomon said, I want to be, have wisdom because I'm going to be governing this great nation of Israel. I want to be wise. And God said, I liked your answer because many people would ask for gold, for winning over their enemies, but you ask for wisdom. That's a very smart choice. I'll give you wisdom, I give you gold, I give you victory over your enemies. And then the wisdom was proverbial. In the Old Testament, they give this example, judgment that he had. Two women come to him. One of them says, we both, this woman and I, both had a child. She, her child died in the night. She stole my child and brought the dead body to my crib. I want my child back. The other woman said, no, 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 she is lying. So they were shouting, arguing. At some point, Solomon said, okay, guards, get the child, cut the child into two, give one half to one woman, the other half to the other woman. That's my solution. When the guard came to cut the child into half, one of the women shouted, no, don't do that, this is my child. Sorry, don't do that. And at that point, Solomon knew who the real mother was, the one who didn't want the child to die. A simple experiment that needed just one repetition that told him that there is a, you know, the true mother would shout that. The woman who was not the mother said, okay, cut the child and divide. Concluding remarks, we are already over time. Give me just a couple of seconds to present the results. Experimental, quasi-experimental, two sides of the same coin. And all of them are to eliminate rival hypotheses. If you have other ways of eliminating hypotheses, wonderful. It's a good idea to replicate, especially surprising results. Replicate to see if you get the same result next time. Common sense is important, but it's well-informed common sense, not just I'm born and I'm wise, I'm smart. No, you need to know the hundreds of years of developments in order to apply common sense here. And then there will be other designs. So keep your eyes open, use your brain, because you may be the one who designs the 15th or 16th design. And the main purpose is to make you critical recipient, so that you are aware of things that can be going on here wrongly. Thank you very much. Thank you. Sorry for extending.